Bienvenidos and welcome to a special edition of the Familia FFP podcast. Today we're joined by someone whom I grew to admire very much during my days at the Dodgers, Ned Colletti. Ned was an executive in MLB for more than 30 years with the Cubs, Giants, and Dodgers. The last nine seasons, he was the GM of the Dodgers, and the team went to the postseason five times during those years, including three trips to the NLCS. Since 2014, he's made the successful transition to the sports broadcasting set as an analyst on the Emmy-winning Sportsnet LA Dodger Telecast, as well as being a frequent guest analyst on postgame Dodger Talk on AM 570. In 2017, he became a best-selling author with the great book, The Big Chair, Inside the Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces from Inside the World of the Acclaimed Los Angeles Dodgers GM. A couple years ago, he became a scout with the San Jose Sharks in the NHL, making him one of the few executives in two professional sports. He's also a professor of sports administration at Pepperdine University. Ned, it's a great honor to have you on the Familia FFP podcast. As Jaime Jarrín would say, gracias, bienvenidos, es un placer. When I look at your career, you know, when we met first in 2006, you know, I told you how great it was to see someone who got his start in sports writing, move up the ranks. You know, what skill sets did you rely upon from your writing days to help you keep growing professionally and acquiring more responsibility?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think writing is like conversation. And writing is, the more you do, the better you get at it. I think the more you can fine-tune not only your words, but your thought process. And so I think it's been a great skill to have. I was not a high-end high school student. There was no four-year university. I'm from Chicago. There was no four-year university in the state of Illinois that would accept me out of high school. So I had to figure out how to learn. I had to figure out how to get better at all sorts of things if I was going to have a career of any note going forward. And so writing was something that I liked, so I started to pursue that. Loved sports, played three sports, played ice hockey, played soccer, and played a ton of baseball. But anybody from the Midwest knows your baseball season is about half as long as it is if you're in California. So I was good enough to play. I was good enough to captain. I knew I was not good enough to make a living playing it. So I decided I would write about it and pursue a degree in journalism. First an associate's degree from Triton College, a little JC near my this town I grew up in, Franklin Park, near O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and then went on to Northern Illinois University, where I got a bachelor's degree in journalism. I wrote sports for about 4 years, and was a great honor to do it. My last sports writing job was in Philadelphia, where I had a chance to cover the Philadelphia Flyers. Then my dad got sick, and he, as a young man, got sick at 49, died at 51 of lung cancer, and the newspaper business was going through a very tough period of time. So newspaper I was on folded right before Christmas. And we had our first child in October. I had a nice mortgage of about 18% back in those days. And was fortunate that I could come back to Chicago and be with my mom and dad through my dad's illness and death, and also start a baseball career, which I've been very blessed to have the opportunities that I've had.
And, you know, in your book, and you know, you shared with me, you know, during our conversations back in the Dodger days, you know, you talked about that working class upbringing and that influence, kind of that grit that upbringing gave you. How were you able to translate those influences, and especially the influences from your parents, into your career?
That's a great question, I thank you for asking it. Because my parents are both deceased now, but a day does not go by without me thinking of them and thinking about how they would react to a certain situation. My father was a factory worker. My mom was a wife, mom, cook, housekeeper, organizer, boss, kept everything going. She worked in the home even though we didn't have any financial wherewithal whatsoever. I lived in a house that was 900 square feet. It's after moving out of a garage. We lived in a garage till I was five. My parents had been married 10 years by the time they moved into a home that was 900 square feet. I think what it taught me was the value of hard work, the value of getting a job done that was acceptable and hopefully would exceed somebody's expectations who asked you to do that job. My dad could fix anything, and he would never charge again, even though we were struggling financially. Any neighbor on the block, on the street, knew that they could call my dad to fix him with a furnace, he could fix their plumbing, their heating, their air conditioning, their carpentry work, fix their car, whatever, and he would just do it out of the goodness of his heart. So I learned work ethic. I also learned kindness. I also learned gratitude. I also learned grace through my parents and how they treated others and how they respected people. I lived in a very diverse neighborhood, and everybody, and this was, you know, I grew up in the 60s, so not everything was peaceful, but in our neighborhood, everything was, because we all worked together for the good of the group. And they taught me a lot of human instincts, human reactions, and I still use it today, you know, and I'm not afraid of hard work. I'm not afraid of long hours. I like challenges, and I like the opportunity to exceed an expectation. I love having somebody expect something out of me and then having a chance to make it even better than they thought. And so those are some of the things my parents taught me: hard work, kindness, gratitude, grace.
And that actually ties into something that I was going to ask you about later, but it kind of fits right now. It was something that early on you said, and it's something that I've really adopted in my own life, where you told me that, and it's something you mentioned in your book multiple times, the only thing you can control is your own effort. How important is that, to keep that in mind when, you know, considering what's happening on the field is a win or a loss?
Well, it took a long time for me to get to that point. And I think the turning point for me was actually early in my Dodgers career, probably 06, 07, and 08, when the job is so big. And people don't understand how big that job is. I've worked for three iconic franchises, the Cubs, the Giants, and the Dodgers. The Giants and the Cubs are great, iconic franchises, but the wheel that is the Dodgers is a steamboat wheel compared to a bicycle wheel for the other couple. And I think how I really came to discover what I told you was the time that you have in your day is limited. And so I couldn't get swept away with all the things that happen in the course of a day that are out of your control. And most of the things that happen in our days are out of our control. But what is in our control is our effort, how we look at things, how we're willing to sacrifice, how we're willing to work, how we're willing to treat people. That stuff is basically in most of our control. And so I just decided, hey, I'm going to spend my day worrying about things I got a chance to make better. The rest of the stuff, what somebody thinks about this or somebody thinks about that, I can't change that. So, you know, that's going to waste my time in a way. It's like an athlete, you know, an infielder. They can't do anything about the infield grass. They can't do anything about the dirt surface. They can't do anything about the pitch. They can't do anything about the umpire. Can't do anything about the weather. There's a long list of things an athlete, I just gave you an infielder there, has no control over. So why worry about it? Why think about it? You're just going to have to do the best you can with what you have control over.
Oh, that's awesome. And I remember, you know, in your book, you know, you talked about how you made the move from PR onto the baseball operations side by, you know, kind of being one of the early adopters of statistical analysis, kind of how you use that to make projections for players. And, How did you approach that? I ask that in a way because, you know, people who play, you know, who want to sit in the big chair like you, but do it from a fantasy sports standpoint, they're, you know, it's projecting ahead, looking ahead what their player is going to do.
Well, there's all sorts of ways of doing it. You know, I think that most of my projection was done on seeing a player, meeting their parents, seeing how they played, seeing how they went through a tough period of time, either personally or professionally, not professionally, if they're amateurs, but athletically. And I think I learned a lot from that. I could look at analytics and trends and you know, here's a player that's done this at this age. Here's other players who have done the same thing at that age. But when you're talking about amateurs, it's really difficult because who do they do this against? Who do they play against? Did they play in the big leagues or in the NFL or whatever sport? You know, you're playing against arguably the best in the world every day. So your expectation of the talent, and when you do a statistical analysis of the talent, it's all pretty much on the same playing field, so to speak. You start amateurs and it's different. You have different caliber high schools athletically, different caliber athletes. Some are bigger and developed, some are smaller and not there yet. Collegiately, you've got different divisions of competition. You've got teams that are Division I that play in Southern California. You have teams that are Division I that are playing in Minnesota, you know, so the weather's different, the training's different. So it's a little bit tougher to gauge a projection when you're talking about amateur competition. But, you know, going back to my Cub days in analytics, I was fortunate to have, A, an interest in analytics and statistics, and B, the third manager I worked for with the Cubs, first was Lee Elia, and then was Charlie Fox for an interim period, and then was Jim Fry. And Jim Fry he was in Kansas City, manager in 80 when they went to the World Series, and was a coach for the Mets. But prior to that, he worked for the Baltimore Orioles and Earl Weaver, Hall of Fame manager. And Earl was way ahead of his time. He's known today, if people even remember Earl Weaver, they remember somebody who won a lot of games, who was kind of fiery and demonstrative and used to get tossed from a lot of different games by umpires. But he was also analytical. And so Jim Fry, as a coach, would keep track of how hitters did against certain pitchers. And he kept an index card. And he had a copy, and Earl had a copy, and Earl would refer to this during a game. This is way before computers. And when he came to Chicago in the winter of 83, before the 84 season, he asked me if I would do that. And I did. And we didn't have any internet to go back and research. It was all paging through box score after box score. But I started keeping track of that. And then we designed a computer system with Tribune Company, which was the owner of the team, to measure how hitters did in close and late situations when we defined that. You know, seventh inning later, down by one run, two runs, three runs, or tied. How pitchers did down by one, up by one. And so we built a computer system with the intellect of the designers at Tribune Company. And we built it with the knowledge that we had in the baseball department. And so we did that probably well before anybody, or before most teams, I'm guessing. I mean, this was 1983, 84, 85, and when this thing started to develop. And we used it up until, you know, they probably still use it after I left for San Francisco after the 93 season. But, you know, I think you learn a lot by analytics. I think you see a lot. I think you can see trends. I think defensively in baseball, it's obviously made a huge difference as to where defenders play. I also think that the humanness of an athlete is also got great value. And so the combination of both is what I tried to use. I think in my GM days, I was probably known as somebody who didn't really think about analytics and was all scout-oriented, but that's only because people didn't pay attention or really ask me the question. You know, that came out the way it came out because that's what people wanted to believe. But designed the first one in Chicago, have always used it, continue to use it. I use it in the NHL with my scouting with San Jose, and I'll always use it because it's information. Anybody who shuts down information, I think, is not doing justice to their role as a leader or as an employee. You shut out information, shame on you, whether it's analytical, whether it's scouting, whether it's people you know and trust, people you're getting to know, people you're getting to trust. I think all information is valuable. Even the information from those that tell you that A is happening when it's not really happening. And so you may be misguided for a minute or two, but you've just learned information about the person who gave it to you. You don't want to go back to that person. So there's something to be learned every day. Analytics works, scouting works, evaluation of people works always. Giving people opportunity. Many times you'll see a player that struggles to really catch fire with another club, and then suddenly he ends up with, or she ends up with, a team, and the environment that is created suddenly makes the player so much different and freer and better. Kike Hernandez on the Dodgers, Max Muncy, maybe one of the greatest examples of all time.
God, yes.
With the Dodgers. So, you know, all those things go into the evaluation of an athlete to me. Also, one more thing is when I scout, most athletes think they get scouted when the game begins. I would scout almost 24 hours a day on somebody I wanted to draft, somebody I wanted to acquire contract-wise, because it was you learn a lot. You learn a lot about their lifestyle, about how they sacrifice, if they're well, how they react to adversity, how they react to defeat, how they react to a 1-for-15 batting slump, how they react to giving up 2 home runs in an inning that cost a game, how they portray themselves on the internet, who their friends are. These are all important things, even to scout the scouts. You know, some scouts are great with pitching. Some scouts are great with hitting. Some scouts don't like any player. Some scouts like every player. You have to know. You have to scout the people who you're going to ask for information.
That's awesome. I was going to ask you about the human element, but you already covered that. How important is it when, you know, looking to project a player for just the upcoming season? How important is it to be looking forward and not be looking on the stats in the back of that person's baseball card?
Well, I think, you know, there's some saying about history, you know, if you don't pay attention to it, you'll keep repeating it. And I think you have to take that into consideration, but you have to also, I think, really kind of get to know the player and how they think. And maybe somebody's, as a hitter, has really had trouble with off-speed stuff. And what they did all winter long is that's what they worked on. And they spent time, and they just didn't spend time doing it, but they spent their time preciously and really dug into it and really sought wisdom from those people who could help them. And they may show up in camp and say, you know what, I think I'm going to be better. And so you have to give them that chance, and you have to, you know, maybe ask them, why do you think you're going to be better, and have them explain it. I think when people explain something, it has far greater reach than if they don't have to explain it. I think when you explain something, it kind of verifies it in your mind. May also have you change course on it if you say something out loud that doesn't necessarily make complete sense that you thought it did when you first thought about it. So all these things go into it. And so if somebody has had a weakness in their game at any point in time, and they've told you they're working on it, and this is how they're working on it, and this is what they've done, you've got to give that player a chance. You got to give them a chance to show what they can do at that point in time, because they may have fixed it. You know, Justin Turner, when we signed Justin, he just got his 1,000th hit the other day. You know, I'm so proud of Justin Turner. This kid was an extra man that got non-tendered by the Mets and sat on the free agent market for a couple months as we waited for the market to kind of sort itself out, and I needed an extra man, and I liked how he hit. I wasn't sure how much I liked the defense at second base, or could stand at shortstop for a minute, or third base, and signed him. He had a real rough April, his first April, and then he caught fire, and then he really changed his game, and he worked at it. He worked all winter long at his approach at the plate to become the hitter he is now. He worked at something that is really hard to change, and that is your first step quickness and your anticipation. And he's become, if Arenado was not in the National League, Justin Turner may have a Gold Glove award on his mantle, you know? So there's a player that was in his later 20s who played professionally for a while, a lot of it in the minor leagues, or a lot of it on the bench, but who worked so hard at his craft to become as good as he has become to be. One of the best players in the game and one of the best leaders in the game. And it's people like that. Ross Stripling, same thing. You know, we drafted Ross, and we knew right away that the kid had great intellect and a great feel for pitching. He didn't have, if you remember Ruby De La Rosa or Alan Webster, absolutely. He didn't have the stuff that they had. But he was so dedicated to figuring out his craft and to maximize what he could do. Teams would ask me about Stripling a little bit, but they really asked me about De La Rosa and Alan Webster all the time, and I ended up trading them to those two kids to Boston in the Adrian Gonzalez deal. But Ross Stripling, nobody could have ever gotten away from him because of how he approached it. And look at him now. You know, he pitched the other day and had it, you know, didn't get the win, but he was trying to become the Major League's first four-game winner in this truncated season. You know, that's pretty strong. He was an All-Star 2 years ago. That's because he worked at it. That's because he took the time to figure out how to take an 8 and make it a 9, or a 9 and make it a 10, or a 3 and make it a 5. He figured it out. And I just mentioned two players. There's hundreds of them. That's why they're in the show. That's why they're in the big leagues or the NFL or the NBA or MLS or NHL. You know, that's why they're the best at what they do, is because of their ability to adapt and to change, or to take tremendous God-given talent and retain it and fine-tune it.
And I think that's one thing you told me early on. It's measuring how a player wants to be great. And that was another thing that stuck with me about, can you evaluate that in any way?
Well, you can, but I think that is something that you really find out more with time, right, and experience and observation. I've been around a handful of players, and some of it's because of the salary structure. In professional sports, if you're really good, if you're just a good player, you're going to make a great living. Okay, to be great takes a different commitment, and it takes a commitment of elevating your abilities and your thought process. It also takes the commitment to continue to do it. I had a player tell me once that I said, you know, you might be able to be a triple crown threat: home runs, RBIs, batting average. You're that good. He said, I don't want to be that good, because then you're going to expect me to be that good every year. I'd rather just be good and not have to worry about that type of expectation. And I'm sure he's not the only player out there that is thinking that. And, you know, I think there's a difference between that. I think there's some that want to be Tom Brady, that want to win everything they compete against. I think Clayton Kershaw is one of those guys, wants to win everything he does, whether it's the ping pong, the title in the fundraiser in the summer, or whether it's a exhibition game in the spring, or whether it's a postseason game. And I think that, you know, that's what you look for in your athletes. There's some athletes, and I'll use the baseball season as a gauge. There's some athletes that can help you get to October, but they're not going to necessarily help you in October. And there are some athletes that will be average until October, and then suddenly the light gets hot and they get hot, and they can't wait for that opportunity to make history. They're all over the board. And so you have to kind of know who's who and visualize them in those situations and see if they fit. See if they fit. They may only be that April to October player. But they can help you get there. You just have to know that as you think about your team. And people can surprise you, and many times I hope that they surprise me on the good end. But, you know, you just have to pay attention. The study of people is phenomenal. It's one that will never end, and it's one that I think about every day. I think about it nonstop.
Oh, that's outstanding. So you're one of the rare people who's been able to be an executive with two major professional sports, different sports. Obviously, the long career with the Dodgers. Now you're scouting for the San Jose Sharks. What, you know, talent evaluation, what is consistent in talent evaluation across multiple sports?
Well, I think what we've talked about a little bit right now, Jorge, and that's the how does a player play?
Right.
Do they put everything into it? Do they try to cheat the day? Do they refuse to cheat the day? Do they give max effort all the time? Not everybody can give, quote, 100% every day, but everybody should give 100% of what they can give every day. You know, that is universal. Doesn't matter if it's a sport, if it's a business, if it's a family, if it's a buddy. Doesn't matter. It's universal. In athletics, what I've found to be some of the traits that cross over are how does the hands work? How do the feet work? How does the mind work? How's decision-making work? How quick is it? How accurate is it? And I think if you think of all the sports we watch, you got hands, you got feet, you got thought process. And I think as you look at, take an NBA player, any player you want, you'll check out how do they move? How do they shoot? How do they pass? How do they receive a ball? How do they think? Can they think quick? As their thought process, not only quick, but accurate. Do they think faster than the competition? Doesn't matter if they're on ice, if they're on hardwood, if they're on grass, if they're on artificial turf. It's those components, I believe, are all the same.
Now, when you're doing a trade, I think this is valuable to talk to you. What did you find is the most important for outcome for both sides, because you're not just looking to win from your side?
Well, I think there's a few things that I would always think of. There were some players, prospects, that I knew were not going to be able to play in the market I was working in.
Right.
Not everybody's made to be a Dodger. Doesn't mean they're not going to be a big league player, but are they going to be a great Dodger? Maybe not. So those players that had a higher ranking on the outside than we knew on the inside, you have expectation, LA. You got in a normal season, 50,000 people come to the ballpark every day. You're expected to get to the Fall Classic and win it every year, not once in a while. Some teams are trying to finish 500. The Dodgers are not trying to ever finish 500. So you have to look at your prospects and figure out who fits what you're trying to do. And you can't be afraid of trading somebody who's going to play in the big leagues, okay? Because the other team, you know, they're paying attention too. They know who can and who can't. They may not know the market and know that the player we think can't necessarily be a great Dodger, but could play in the big leagues. They may not know that piece of it. But you don't worry about that. I would make sure that we traded the right prospects who we did not think could be great Dodgers. And at the other side, what you get back is you have to make sure you've got the right character, that you've got somebody that's going to fill the expectation that you have, whether it's position, whether it's part of your pitching staff, whether it's a hitter in your lineup that can be a run producer or somebody who gets on base all the time. You got to make sure that you've kind of narrowed it down and seek those that you feel can close a gap for you. And as far as who you trade back, if you don't think they're going to be a great Dodger, you think they will play in the big leagues, but you're getting what you need back and you've done all your work and you've worked through it and you've asked yourself and you've asked other people enough questions to really vet the situation, then you do it. And if somebody else turns out to be a good player someplace else and you get what you needed, that's okay. I think a lot of people out there like to see the team always get the better of every deal. Well, you know, this isn't the fantasy league. This is, you know, this is the big leagues, the real thing. So a lot of times you're going to have to give up players. And I think we did a decent job during my tenure there. We gave up one player we knew was going to be a good player in Carlos Santana. We needed Casey Blake. We needed a third baseman. We weren't in a financial situation to take on salary, so the Cleveland Indians paid all of Casey's salary, and in return, we had to give him Carlos Santana, who we had questions about, and I had my best scouts look at him. He's a minor league player. He's in high A ball when we dealt him. And our best scouts look at him, and they thought, kid'll hit. Kid's going to be able to develop a good on-base percentage. He's going to be okay, but we don't know if he's going to be a big league catcher. And we had a young guy named Russell Martin who was 2 years into his big league career, I think, 2-3 years, and obviously became a very, very good player. And right from the outset, the big leagues was an excellent player. So we had a little bit of a surplus there. And as it turned out, Carlos Santana went off to have a great, great career with Cleveland mainly. And, walked a lot, had a hit for high average, had some power. After a couple of years, didn't catch much. Ended up being a DH. So I was obviously I wasn't going to play in the National League until a pandemic struck and you stopped having the pitcher hit. So, he's probably the best player I traded. And we knew it going in that the kid was going to be a big league player. We just happened. We thought we had a surplus. We thought we had a glaring need, and we weren't sure if that player was going to be at the same position as his career continued to develop.
Well, got a couple more. You're since 1986, your brother has been with the Bears in their broadcast crew. How much has that kind of kept you connected to, I guess, the Bears and the NFL?
Well, quite a bit, and I'm really proud of my brother too. My brother is 6 years younger than me, and as I told you the story at the outset of our conversation here about my dad getting sick, I was off in Philly working. My brother was still in school, so my brother had the lion's share of the sorrow and trying to help everything out there, and he did a great job. And then he also looked after our mom for many years after my dad had passed, since my brother has an accounting degree and sharp with finances. So he's done a great job that the two of us have worked in professional sports more than 75 years, and my son scouted for a long time. So, the Colletti boys are probably in the high 80s in number of years that they've worked in professional sports, which is amazing to me. When you grow up, how we grew up in a very, very blue-collar, tough neighborhood. None of my buddies' dads went to work with a sport coat or a suit and tie. Everybody worked in a factory. Everybody labored. And to be able to have great careers and be able to work in something that we absolutely love working in, where the only time you look at the clock is to make sure you're not late for something, not because the day is dragging. It's been I think a huge blessing for all of us, and that my brother's had the career he's had as almost a secondary moonlighting career has been very special for our family. And then I know my brother Doug feels the same way.
How was the transition from just the 24/7 grind of being a GM to the broadcasting side? When you made that move after the 2014 season?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I did know that suddenly I had time, and time is precious. And when you're a GM, it's rare you're not thinking about your team. I don't care if it's the middle of December, you're thinking about your team. And obviously a baseball season goes from really Valentine's Day to hopefully Halloween for those teams that make it into the fall classic. So it's a long period of time, and then you're off season. Suddenly it's not there and you have all this time. So I started to work on the book, not as a book, but just to get some of the things out of my mind, out of my head, and put them on paper. And did that for about 5 or 6 months, from about 10 p.m. to 3 a.m., 4 or 5 days a week. And discipline myself to do it so I would have something in my day to look forward to and be responsible for, even if it's just for me. I had never had time off since I was about 14 years old, so it was kind of a something I wasn't accustomed to and really didn't know what to do with all of it. And then the Dodgers asked me very quickly after I left the GM job if I had an interest in doing TV. I said, absolutely. Keeps me close to the game. I work for great people at Spectrum Sportsnet LA. Lon Rosen, who runs the broadcasting and marketing for the Dodgers, has been great to me and given me this opportunity. Eric Braverman, same thing. Stan Kasten, as the president of the club, everybody said, hey, this could be good for everybody. And I greatly appreciated that. And it's been cool. It's been cool to do it. We've been We've been honored with 3 Emmys in the 5 years I've done it, and that's a team Emmy. That's everybody contributes to that. John Hartung, Jerry Hurston, Nomar Garciaparra, Oral Hershiser, Alana Rizzo, everybody on the set, all the people that work behind the cameras have been terrific. Maybe the best place I've ever worked, as far as how people really just have fun and work together for the great of the organization. Then I started teaching school at Pepperdine, and I've done that for 9 semesters now. I'll be starting up another one here shortly. And then the San Jose Sharks opportunity came about a couple years ago. So I'm busy. I got what really amounts to 3 full-time jobs. I should be probably thinking about shutting it down at some point here, but I do love what I do. I love having a chance to compete, which I can do at San Jose. I love the chance to help people, which I can do at Pepperdine. And I love the chance to have somebody have a great day and be part of a tiny reason why. And I get to do that, hopefully, with the television and with the viewership. So all is good, but a little bit of transition, perhaps, and different careers. Been blessed beyond measure so many times. You know, I don't deserve half of what I've been able to be able to do. I don't know if I deserve even half of it, but I've been really blessed to have opportunity. And then going back to something you mentioned way at the outset again, too, about what you learned from your parents. You know, I don't take anything for granted, and I don't try to cheat the day. I try to give a full effort and then some across the board, even in the latter stages of my working life.
Yeah, I mean, as we close this, you know, I'm reminded of the closing of your book where you're visiting one of the true treasures that we got to meet at the Dodgers, Billy Dullery, at the hospital, where he told you about, you know, kind of getting some of that life back. You know, it sounds like the plate's still really full, but it's still like you're still enjoying it.
Well, all right, you know, we only have so many days, and you know, there's a lot of different things that you can lose and recapture, money, for example, things like that. But you can't really create a whole lot more time. And I just try to enjoy my days. I try to make my days as good as they can be. Doesn't have to be fancy. Doesn't have to be extravagant. I just look for a good day. And a good day for me usually has family involved, good people involved, working involved, and helping somebody out. That's when I get done with my day and I put my head on a pillow and I can check off most of those boxes. Thank God for another great day.
Well, you know, I thank God for Ned, the time we've been able to spend together, having conversations and working together, and for reconnecting. And I thank you so much for this time. This was, you're a true treasure, and I really just, you know, value your kinship, and I just thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ned.
Well, thank you for reaching out and asking me. I'm very glad that you did. Great to talk to you again. It's been a little bit of time here, and great to reconnect. I wish you the best, and be well, my friend.
Bueno, eso es todo for our show. I want to thank Ned Colletti for giving us a peek inside what it takes to sit in the big chair as the GM of a professional sports franchise. Thanks again to Anchor.fm for being our hosting network and for making sure our independent podcast gets out into the Familia community. Please subscribe and leave us a review on Google, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at FamiliaFFB, as well as our Familia FFB Facebook page. Gracias, everybody, and remember, todos somos familia.